Welcome to Global Minnesota Podcasts, connecting, informing, and engaging Minnesotans with the world and exploring important international issues. For a complete list of programs and to join us, visit globalminnesota.org.
I like the topic that we are focusing on today. I'm a folklorist. I enjoy the folklore of the whole world, from ancient times to the present. Across cultures, that's really my passion, folklore. If you want, at question time, I can define folklore, but it might take the whole night. The other thing is, I'm very proud of my African heritage, and so I'll start on that note. That's what I tell my students, the centrality of Africa, and how and why I really like talking about it, and reminding people about the importance of Africa. Briefly, as we all know, the scientists are telling us that Africa is the cradle of the human race. The cradle of the human race. Now that carries a lot of significance. What it means is that's where we humans learned to use tools, to make tools and use tools. Anthropologists will tell us that. That's what happened, that's what helped to make us human. That's where we began to walk on two legs, on two limbs. That was a great revolution because it freed the hands for other things. And that's where we learned to make and use language. The evolution of language is very central. Without it, nothing could have happened throughout civilization. There would be no science, there is no social organization, there would be nothing. Language is so central. And it's something that evolved there. We need to think a bit deeply about this. As we talk to each other, you know, we don't even imagine how hard it must have been to create language. Imagine you are the earliest humans. Imagine you are the earliest humans. You couldn't just walk to the neighbor and say, "Hey, how are you today? You know, can I borrow some salt? Or some of the antelope that you killed yesterday?" No, it wasn't that way. There was no such thing as a sentence, no such thing as the word. They were just sounds. You can imagine how it must have been, just grunting and yelling and making strange noises before you could begin to form words so that another person could understand what you were saying, before you could begin to say hello, before you could begin to say "that's a snake over there," or even the word "snake." I'm kidding, because they never spoke English in those days. So the example is just to make a point. They didn't speak English. They didn't speak Italian. I don't even know what they spoke. But it was just sounds. It was just sounds. And they had to work through those sounds. We don't know for how long. Hundreds of thousands of years, maybe, before they could make sentences. We don't know how long it took. Now, together with that, they evolved storytelling. And my definition of storytelling starts in a very simple, you know, way. When they named things, just naming things, you know, snake, lion, tree, I see those as stories already. Because when you say snake, you are really saying a lot of things. You are saying it's something that crawls, you know, it's something that can bite you, it's something that you need to run away from when you see it, it's something that you don't eat, all kinds of things. It's not a worm, it's not a lizard. The names are already embryonic stories. That's what I'm saying. There are already stories in microcosm. That's what I'm saying. So from those words, you make sentences of different kinds, you evolve language. It must have taken thousands of years. Today, you and I can just meet and start talking, and we don't think about the difficulties, you know, that were involved in creating this thing we take for granted. And it all happened in Africa. That's the point I'm trying to make here. You couldn't create language, you couldn't create stories, except in the context of the evolution of the brain itself, the evolution of the mind. Consciousness itself had to be developing for you to be able to create language, to communicate, to store those memories that we store in languages, to philosophize about life, about reality, to explain things. Telling a story as we know it involves a lot of mental processes. Telling a story, it involves decoding language, interpreting language, it involves imagination, it involves so many things. Back to my original statement, when I think of Africa, I think about all this. And so it was not just stories that they created, it was other forms of folklore. It was songs, proverbs, riddles, myths, legends, jokes, curses, incantations, prayers. Unfortunately, it was all oral, so we don't have written records. But it's an intelligent speculation to say all these things. We don't have the records. We fast forward hundreds of thousands of years to ancient Egypt. There, they invented a writing system. They invented writing in Egypt. Around the same time, you know, they invented writing, you know, in the Sumerian Empire, in the country called Iraq. But let me get back to Egypt, because that's Africa. A writing system called hieroglyphics, and it involved a lot of technology, processing these reeds that grow in the Nile, you know, river, along the Nile River, processing them to make something that you can write on. They didn't make books, but they used these papyrus reeds. They processed them in some ways to make a surface on which you could write. And the writing script, the writing system, the hieroglyphic script, it's a kind of picture writing, not our own Roman script. Why am I saying all this? I'm saying this. For the first period that I've talked about, stories were all oral. There was no writing. It was only strings of sounds. That's what language was. There was no visual equivalent. There was no visual equivalent. You could not represent those words visually. If you said global Minnesota, it was just sounds. The moment you finished saying it, it was gone. There was no trace of it, except perhaps in your mind. But with writing, things changed dramatically, because you could actually represent global Minnesota. Now, this is not ancient Egyptian. Global Minnesota is Think of the difference. Today, you and I, if I say global Minnesota, automatically you think about how it is written down. Automatically, you cannot even tell me that, oh, no, I don't think about that. You will not be telling that the truth. We are so addicted to the visual system of language. Anyway, so when the Egyptians learned to write, two things happened. First, they were able to write down their traditional oral stories. And we do have some records of those stories. I've read a few of them. I've read three of them. From the ancient Egyptians, the earliest recorded stories come from there. First one that is available, it has been deciphered, it has been translated into English and other languages, the tale of two brothers. Another one is called the tale of the shipwrecked sailor. Shipwrecked sailor. Another one is called the story of Senuhe. Senuhe is a character. Long stories. I couldn't tell them. Would have to spend the whole night if I did. These stories coming from those ancient times actually set the pattern for all the stories we are telling. I mean, those early humans in the oral phase when there was no writing, they invented everything we know about storytelling, how to construct a plot, how to develop characters, how to present conflict, and themes like adventure, revenge, love, conflict. They worked out all these things in those days before writing. So if we are talking about the persistence of storytelling from the oral to the written, we just need to think about this. I do not think we are able to invent any new stories. You read a novel, you watch a film, you will find parallels or antecedents in ancient Greece, in ancient Egypt, ancient, you know, Mesopotamia. That is one thing I find intriguing. You fast forward from the ancient Egyptians, fast forward thousands of years, about 4,000 years. 4,000 years. Then you come to modern African literature. Yes, those novelists, those poets, writing in African languages like Swahili, they're writing in African languages like Hausa. They've also acquired Arabic script in Northern Africa, Eastern Africa, and they are capable of actually creating stories in writing. So you have somebody sitting somewhere and actually creating a story. That's how you get the novelists. It's different from folklore, because folklore is traditional, you don't know the authors, it's passed on from generation to generation. But now, with our topic, we come to the present phase where we have writers, African writers, sitting down, writing novels, you know, writing whatever they are writing, plays, poetry, and so on. And here's the connection. Having been brought up in the oral traditions, like I was, because I grew up in an oral culture, basically, you learn the stories, you know, the folklore stories, the folk tales. You learn how they are constructed. You learn the principles, the aesthetic principles. We call them aesthetic principles. The sense of what's the proper story, you know, the construction of it, the plot, the ending, characterization, and all these things. So when you're starting to write a novel, you are actually guided by that understanding of how stories are made. And here's the problem, and I believe, you know, my brother here, whom I've known for more than 20 years, Mzenga, we will probably agree on that. He's a specialist on the literature part. The early African writers, they wrote those novels, and I'm saying they were really influenced by the storytelling tradition. So the way they constructed those plots, the way they developed the themes, the characterization, the absence of certain things which were standard in European literature, critics did not know how to handle this. They actually faulted this. They talked about early African writings as deficient. They did. They would complain about, the plots, the plot structure is not well developed, characterization is flimsy, you know. There was a play coming from Ghana by a very famous woman playwright, 1963, a play in English. It's called Dilemma of a Ghost. Dilemma of a Ghost. Critics, European critics, not knowing the oral traditional heritage, not knowing the influence of African storytelling, found fault with this play. And I'll quote verbatim. One of the critics said, among the technical faults of this play, the playing time is less than an hour for the five acts into which the play is broken. The issues raised in the play, complicated as they are, tend to disintegrate and lose climactic rhythm, especially in the last two acts, and characters appear or reappear without a clear dramatic reason. The characters appear and reappear on stage without clear dramatic reason. Some disappear completely. So this European critic looks at this play and says, what kind of a play is this? The characters sometimes just disappear completely. Just at the point when the audience begins to identify with them sympathetically. So European critics used to complain about African writing. And these are the kinds of complaints I'm talking about. One of them, another one, talking about the same play, said, it is not well done because, you know, the actors and the playwrights did not have the training, you know, that modern playwriting requires. They didn't have the training. These kinds of things. My point is this. If you're a folklorist, you know the tradition of storytelling, which informed our writers. You will see African literature very differently. You will see they really, in some ways, appropriate the patterns of the oral tradition. And they have elements such as what is called, you know, sparse, you know, characterization. The characterization is not rich. But think about it this way. In oral storytelling, when somebody is performing a folk tale, they use a lot of resources, not just the words. They dramatize the action, you know, they imitate the voice. They do a lot of things which actually give you a very rounded character. The dramatic part is missing when you write a novel. But if you are shaped with that notion of storytelling and you are writing a story, you may end up creating a story that does not satisfy somebody else's standard, you know, the standard of modern European literature. So literacy and the writing tradition can actually influence the way you look at African literature. I could give a lot of examples. You come from Nigeria, you have early writers like Amos Tutuola, an early Nigerian novelist writing in English. You read his novel, The Palm Wine Drinker, that's the title. If you are conversant with folk tales, you can see the influence. You go to South Africa in the 1920s, you see this novelist, Thomas Mofolo. He writes this novel called Shaka, very much following the tradition of Southern African storytelling. You go to Senegal, you find writers like Sembene Ousmane, same thing. You go to Nigeria, you know, in more recent times, Chinua Achebe. Some of you have read Things Fall Apart. Things Fall Apart It imitates a lot of the oral storytelling. It incorporates actually stories, traditional stories, and also it incorporates songs. Just like in the folk tale, a lot of African folk tales, you know, and I grew up with those tales. The narrator is telling the story, the audience is sitting there, they are not passive. There are moments when you sing a song. The storyteller will sing the song, and after they've done it, you are supposed to sing along with them if the song is repeated, which is very typical. So you participate. So you read these novels, and they have songs in them. You know, the same thing with the South African novel I've mentioned, Shaka. It has the narrative, and it has songs. Now, this is something that you also see in African-American literature. Our conversation is meant to go beyond Africa to the Americas. Because of the slave trade, millions of Africans were taken to this part of the world. They came with their stories. They came with their folklore. They came with proverbs. They came with folk tales. They came with the kind of criteria I'm talking about of constructing stories, the aesthetic principles that I'm talking about. So you pick up a novels such as those of Zora Neale Hurston. Zora Neale Hurston. There's so much storytelling going on in Zora Neale Hurston's stories. You pick novels by Toni Morrison. Song of Solomon, to give an example. Go back, look at Song of Solomon. There are songs in there, just like the African storyteller does, you know, just like the African folk tale, you know. I don't want to give the technical term for this kind of folk tale. You know, I was told this is just a conversation, and I'll keep it at that level. It's a conversation. Folklorists have terms to describe this type of folk tale, which incorporates songs. And I'm saying, you look at the novelists, African-American, African-Caribbean, they carry over some of those features. Toni Morrison writes a novel called Tar Baby. Now, the Tar Baby is a series of stories, folk tales, in African tradition, and I could spend the whole evening telling you real folk tales. You should invite me another day. So we could just do folk tales. I love doing folk tales and talking about them. Tar Baby, that's the title of a very famous type of story which is common all over Africa, in many parts of Africa, but also common even in Native American traditions. Oh yes, it has been recorded, I think, among the Cherokee nation. You go to the Caribbean, same thing. You go to the Caribbean, it's the same thing. I will have to stop soon because I was told we have to split the time so we can have questions. I was forgetting that I'm not the only speaker. Yeah. Oh, he thinks I should be the only speaker. Oh, okay. So, let's go to the Caribbean. You see the same thing. You see the same thing. You read the plays of Derek Walcott. You know, I mean, really, you see a play like Tijan and his brothers. You read that play, three brothers and their mother, and the things that they do, the way they get into adventure, confronting some devil, you know, some devil figure. The mother warns them not to go, they go. The second one goes. And then finally, the little one, he also wants to go. The mother gives them advice. The older ones don't follow the advice. They get snatched by the monster. It's the little one who is wise and attentive and obedient to the mother. This is a pattern of the African folk tales. I could tell you thousands of those tales, you know. You take another writer, Edwidge Danticat of Haiti. Edwidge Danticat, very young writer. She came to St. Paul some years ago. She writes these short stories, And actually, one of her books is titled Creek Crack. Creek Crack is actually a formula common in Africa in different variations. When a storyteller, or when somebody wants to tell a story, they will tell you, you're talking, and they will tell you, creek crack, that's what you do in Haiti. That means, I'm about to tell a story. So when you hear somebody saying creek crack, you keep quiet, it's story time. But a formula like that, you find in all places in Africa, I would say. In Swahili, they would say paukwa, pakawa. In Madagascar, they have formulas like that. Now, I don't speak Malagasy. I wish I could speak it. I don't want to mispronounce the words. Those formulas, in my language, Matengo, we have formulas like that. What I'm saying is this, if we had more time, I would really open this up a bit more to talk about how literature, African literature, African Caribbean, African American literature continues that tradition. And things which look like faults are not actually faults. Let me conclude by saying this. I have attacked the critics who complained about African literature. If they were folklorists, they would simply remember, or they should remember, they should learn, that even if you look at the epics of Homer, the Iliad of Homer, folklorists have figured out that it contains these features of orality, narrative inconsistencies, they're called, or digressions, things like that. Disjointedness, the plot itself is not coherent sometimes, you know, it's repetitive, so there's repetition, narrative inconsistency, disjointedness, digressions, these are all embraced in an oral traditional story. These are all important. This is the way oral traditional stories are formed or performed. So what appear to be shortcomings, we need to rethink them, because if we take the perspective of folklore, they are not shortcomings at all. I'll stop there. I know you might have thousands of questions, and I do want to listen to my brother here, Nzenga Wanyama.
Wow. Thank you. Oh, I don't know how to begin by saying, because I think it just kind of drew out of all the oxygen out of me. And I actually wished for some time that he probably would be the only speaker. I was really enjoying listening to him. And I'm happy, by the way, that he's the folklorist, because I'm not. You know, there is also a sense in which you can be African and have really very little knowledge of folklore. Because even among Africans, we have artists. Really, he's an artist. We are not all like that. I mean, if you saw the way he can perform, I mean, a lot of what he's doing and saying didn't just come out of the didactic experience of books. It's actually some experience he has lived. And I'll tell you about my own life. I had a grandma who didn't know any stories at all. And of course, you can tell that my mother perhaps never really knew anything. I mean, I loved her very much, but my mother was a businesswoman. So, and I don't know from whose influences, because later on I learned that my mother had only 2 weeks of school. But she was a businesswoman. She could count money. She could do all kinds of things. She was such an important influence in our lives. She's the one who inspired everything that we learned from school. But later on, when she came to my house, my mother told me that she had only 2 weeks of school. And the reason she had only 2 weeks of school is that her father hated school, the idea of school, so much that when one time at a drinking spree he heard somebody say that his daughter had been seen at school, he literally cried. Because school was supposed to actually destroy, to contaminate, instead of, you know, as it were, elevate. So I will talk about my experience as a student of literature. I encountered seriously African literature when I went to the university at Nairobi University. And at that time, that's exactly why I'm calling my presentation here Issues, Inspirations, and Influences. Because when I went to Nairobi University, and I'm not talking about undergraduate school, when I went to Nairobi University to do my master's degree, there were a lot of issues being discussed. And some of those issues were actually maybe one of the things that Professor Mbele was trying to inaugurate today. How do you define literature? How do you define literature, especially in the context of colonialism, where you have a written literature in a foreign language being called African literature? I'm sure how a lot of you know Ngugi wa Thiong'o. He has beaten that subject to death. I think Ngugi wa Thiong'o enjoys one of the best platforms ever because that platform is very controversial. There are many contradictions about it, but he enjoys it, the platform, because it gives him the kind of mileage that anyone would desire intellectually in terms of speaker circuits. Everybody wants to hear Ngugi because Ngugi is supposed to be a specialist on African languages. But really, the language he promotes is just one, the Kikuyu language, which is the language that he himself speaks. Yeah. So there is a bit of a contradiction there because, you know, when you think about it, all languages constitute the medium through which a voice might be expressed. And when we talk about voice, really what do we mean? We don't really mean language when we talk about voice. We mean somebody's capacity to influence their world, and that they'll use language to do that. So that language can be just about any language. Obviously, we have a sentimental attachment to our languages. So English turns us off, because English has this relationship with colonialism. But when Ngugi talks about language, he always makes it look like he's not aware of the colonial legacy. It's as if the colonial legacy never happened. I think that you need to be more realistic and say every language is as powerful as those that speak it. So Africans need to gain power, have power in their voice, and then the African languages will become as powerful as they are. I think that's really where we should go when we think about language and the relationship of language to literature. So those were some of the issues being discussed in Nairobi University. How do you define literature? Is it only written stories that are literature? Because, by the way, one of the definitions of literature is that anything that's written is supposed to be literature. You know, that's why we say literature about animals, literature about the environment. So we're saying, no, obviously, it has to do with the way in which you use language. And it can be oral or it can be written. Now, once we establish that it can be oral or written, then we say, oh, we actually had a literature. Because from the colonial perspective, if you didn't have a literature, it means you didn't have a culture. And if you didn't have a culture, then maybe you ran the risk of not being human enough. I'll come back to that. Now, these were the issues at Nairobi University when I decided to undertake a study of a South African writer called Alex Laguma. Alex Laguma is, or was rather, a colored writer. In South Africa, you had colored writers, you had black writers, then you had Indian, and then you had white. The gradations were really sharp. He was colored, but obviously he was oppressed. My interest in Laguma, it just happened to be stylistic. I was going to do a stylistic analysis of Laguma's works, and by the way, I really enjoyed doing that. I delineated three, four different ways in which I could see Laguma's works. I did an analysis in terms of syntax, I did an analysis in terms of flexes, I did an analysis in terms of his figurative language, and I did an analysis in terms of cohesion. In other words, what I'm really saying is that I found this writer technically very competent, Alex Laguma. In fact, that was my interest in his works. I was only trying to use the stylistic arrangement to show how ultimately he's able to depict those apartheid themes. But later on further reading, I realized that Laguma had been jettisoned from the experts, from among the experts. He had been being, in other words, being a South African writer, if you're black or colored, there's no way you can achieve the zenith of your capacity as a writer because it's too volatile for you. Now, remember, those of you who have read some romantic, British romantic poetry, you know a poet called William Wordsworth. William Wordsworth defined poetry as a spontaneous overflow of emotion recollected in tranquility. Recollected in tranquility. I guess what these critics were saying of South African writers is that they don't have any amount of tranquility. They might have emotions, but because they don't have any tranquility at all, they cannot recollect those emotions and distill them into compelling works of literature. Obviously, I disagreed because I had found Laguma really competent. But, I mean, you also might now remember that there is a writer who is really famous and he is Nobel laureate now called Kotze from South Africa. He's written books called Waiting for the Barbarians, Four. What Kotze does in those works is he practices what I call experimental writing. When you're an experimental writer, I think you name your terms, you create your own conventions, and what you do is expect your readers to do what? To unravel those and claim to be able to make a connection between those and what's conventional. But experimental writing, for me, foregrounds opacity. And opacity means that anything can go in terms of interpretation. And of course, it helps the writer because what it does is it enables the writer to get around the censor's pen. Because it's not obvious what he's saying, so the censor can't really decide and pin him down and say, you are saying this. Well, Kotze has done that, and of course, he earned a Nobel Prize. But the question is, to what extent is that helpful if a writer is this sensitive part of the society and he wants ultimately to influence the society? How is that possible to do it through experimental writing? I think that's one of the issues I have with that kind of writing. Now, I think because of the critics' idea that if you are oppressed in a volatile society, you cannot be a competent writer. This created my interest in wanting to find out how black societies around the world have actually managed to tell their stories. And hence, why I call myself a literary historian, because then I came to the United States with the aim of studying African-American literature, not just African-American literature, but really exploring African-American literature from its beginnings to wherever I could get. It took me almost 10 years to do my PhD. It's crazy to admit that. It's not as if I learned anything. You know, a lot of times when you have these big dissertations, and if you come to my house, it's about 600 pages. I don't know what I'm ever going to do with it. But what it means is that you really did not have a focus. You didn't really know what you're doing. But I think that's what was happening to me. I didn't know what I was doing, except that I was interested in understanding something. So I explored from what I consider to be the beginnings. And at the beginnings, This is where I draw those moments I'm calling inspirational moments, because what Professor Mbele was doing, he was looking at what Africa might have done to affect the writings by African Americans. And I'm thinking, those who initially encountered writing actually were African Americans before African state. I think that's a problem. I'm sure he and I will talk about that. But I'm thinking about a writer called Phyllis Wheatley. Phyllis Wheatley, as far as I'm concerned, a genius in her own right, comes from the Senegambia to the United States at the age of seven in 1761. Her name Phyllis, by the way, is the name of the ship upon which she sailed to the United States. And the person who bought her, who purchased her from that ship, was called Wheatley. That's how she became Phyllis Wheatley. 4 years into her life in slavery, Phyllis Wheatley started writing poetry. Poetry in English. I think the Wheatley, the family had, you know, they had been able to observe some kind of precociousness intellectually in her. And likely for her, they were interested in developing it. So they helped her study the Bible, read Latin literature, read English history, read the classics. But the writing is not something they expected would happen. She suddenly started writing, and when she was writing, she didn't write anything else. She actually wrote poetry. Now, this is a time when the movement that you know called the Enlightenment movement had a very particular definitions of humanity. If you had reason, and then you're human. But reason was always manifested by a capacity to write. So writing was key in terms of manifesting that ability to show. But not just writing. If you wrote poetry, that was the zenith of human expression. So for her to write poetry, this was, I mean, a whole lot of people have said that her poetry was not subversive enough. But this was perhaps the most fundamental political statement of the time, that she could actually write, and not just write, but write poetry. Now, one of the things that she did was when she was 20, she actually published a book, a poetry, a work of poetry, and she had a really pretentious title for it, Poems on Various Subjects. Religious and Moral. Incidentally, this is a book that's published in England, because in the United States, no one really admitted that Phyllis Wheatley could write. They had to sit Phyllis Wheatley under an observation, a committee like you are sitting like this, of eminent, educated Bostonians to interview her and her master to establish that she actually was the writer of those poems. But still, they could not publish her in Boston. She had to go to England to get the publication. And she prayed that her work would be read and not subject to severe criticism. Now, that's important, because the person who actually read and offered a critique of her work, of all people, was Thomas Jefferson, the author himself of the Declaration of Independence. And I would like to read for you what he said about Phyllis Wheatley's work. Now, Thomas Jefferson offered what he considered to be a condition for producing poetry. And then he declared that the African met that condition. But he still insisted that what they produced was not poetry. He said, mystery, misery, misery. I don't know, I have this interesting accent. Misery is often the parent of the most affecting touches of poetry. Among the blacks, is misery enough? God knows, but not poetry. Love is the peculiar ostrum of the poet. Their love is ardent, but it kindles the senses only, not the imagination. Religion, indeed, has produced a Phyllis Wheatley. And so he didn't even call her Wheatley, he called her Wheatley. But it could not produce a poet. The compositions published under her name are below the dignity of criticism. Well, he was, of course, offering criticism, even as he said, were below the dignity of criticism. But Phyllis could not win because most of her poetry was a poetry influenced by what she was reading at the time, which were classic Alexander Pope, the Bible, what else? And so one of her poems, for example, is a poem that tends to denigrate Africa. I read for you that. It was mercy brought me from my pagan land, taught me, my benighted soul, to understand that there is a God, that there is a Savior too. Once a redemption neither sought nor knew, some view our sable race with scornful eye. Their color is a diabolic dye. Remember, Christians, Negroes, black as Cain, may be refined and joined the angelic train. Black as Cain may be refined and joined the angelic train. You know, when you read a lot of her poems, you know, there are about 78 poems in this, poems on various subjects. She is, by the way, very, very, very subversive. She's very, very critical of racism. It does not come out near as clearly in that kind of. But what Phyllis Wheatley believed is that religion, Christianity, was civilization. It was not Western civilization. It was religion. And if you did not have Christianity, whether you are African or Western, if you didn't have Christianity, you are not civilized. Does that make sense? If you didn't have Christianity, you are not civilized, whether you are African or Western. And one of the poems that she wrote, actually she addressed to the students at Cambridge, the students at the University of all places, Harvard. And that was the statement she was making. That the ultimate condition for civilization is Christianity. Now, so that is one of, for me, you know, in my exploration, that is one of the most inspirational moments, the example of Phyllis Wheatley. The second one is the example of Frederick Douglass. Frederick Douglass, narrative of the life of Frederick Douglass. Essentially, what Frederick Douglass discovers is that the power that the oppressor has over him is the power of literacy, to read and write. Obviously, you remember that slaveholders, one of the things that they did was to make sure that the slave did not get to know how to read. And if you have read that story, that narrative, one of the things that the master does when Frederick Douglass looks interested in learning how to read and write is he reveals to Douglass that Douglass, first of all, once he learns to read and write, he will understand his condition. And there's nothing as bad as when the slave understands his condition, because what he'll try to do is either get out of that condition or he'll always be miserable in that condition. Now, when Douglass had that, of course, his focus was to learn how to read and write. not just literacy, but if you want literariness, the capacity to use language for ironical communication. And once he wrote his narrative of the life of Frederick Douglass, even the abolitionists who are his friends were shocked by its quality, its literary quality. Right at the center of the book, there is a story. There is what you might call a chiasmus. There's a figure of speech there. When Douglass says, "You have seen how a man was reduced to a slave. You're gonna see how a slave became a man." And what he's really talking about is how he fought back. There is a slave driver to whom he has been attached to break him. The way you break an animal, the way you break a horse. He fought back. He fought back and risked death. But you know, the irony is, the guy had such a reputation as a slave breaker that he did not want for people to know that he had been defeated by this little guy. So he didn't let out that Frederick Douglass had actually fought back. So this little guy fought back and was able to get away with it because of this man's fear that if everybody knew that Frederick Douglass had violated the tradition by fighting back, then he will lose his reputation and therefore never gain access to opportunities to break slaves. And Douglass started a newspaper basically to show that an African American could succeed at a venture like that. He started a newspaper, and in that newspaper he published one of the most important stories about slavery and about how a slave might fight back. So that's the second inspirational moment. Now, the third and fourth and fifth have to do with the Harlem Renaissance. In the Harlem Renaissance, you had three figures: James Weldon Johnson, who eventually became the Secretary General of the NAACP, W.B. Du Bois, and Langston Hughes. Weldon Johnson defined what he argued is the only way that a people who are great can actually show that greatness. I don't want to read what he said, but in a nutshell, he argued, if you have a literature, a developed literature, you are a great people, and the world will know that you are great. So the African Americans can actually do that. They can show their greatness by developing a literature, by writing and publishing, and by showing that they have that capacity. No race, he argued, no race that has a literature has ever been treated as entirely inferior. Very inspirational. Now, Langston Hughes gave a spin to that kind of argument, and he said, but we must use our own folk material. To go back to what Professor Mbele was saying, our literature has to be autonomous. We must use our own standards. Autonomous. We must use our own standards of art. And Langston Hughes as you might know, was a jazz poet. He says, most of my own poems are racial in theme and treatment, derived from the life that I know. In many of them, I try to grasp and hold some of the meanings and rhythms of jazz. Because jazz is one of the most inherent expressions of Negro life in America. The eternal tom-tom beating in the eternal soul, the tom-tom of revolt against weariness, in a white world, a world of subway trains and work, 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 the tom-tom of joy and laughter and pain swallowed in a smile. We younger Negro artists who create now intend to express our individual dark skinned selves without fear or shame. We know we are beautiful, and then he adds, and ugly too. And you can tell that this and ugly too is an afterthought. Because really what he wants to say is that in spite of what they say, we are beautiful and ugly too. Because I want to be realistic here, he says. The tom-tom cries and the tom-tom laughs. We build our temples for tomorrow, strong as we know how. We stand on top of the mountain, free within ourselves. Now, the third one was W.B. Du Bois, who would argue in what he called the criteria of Negro writing, that literature is ultimately propagandistic. We must use literature for social purposes, in other words, it's not just, it's important, of course, for literature to be technically competent, but they have depicted us in their literature. You know, that's in fact the way he sounds. They have depicted us in their literature. They have actually used their literature to show us socially in a particular way. We have to recover that. And so we cannot just focus on being technically competent. We also have to focus on how we can use literature for social purposes. So he would argue, literature is propaganda and always must be. I now want to go back to Africa. How this inspirational moments might have actually influenced writing in Africa. Langston Hughes, in particular, influenced this movement that you might have heard of called the Negritude Movement. The Negritude Movement was started by a group of Africans studying in Paris in France, who were responding to the degrading experience of French colonialism, French policy of assimilation. The French being very inward looking culturally, knew only one way of relating to others, assimilating them. But what were they assimilating? They were assimilating Africans because Africans did not have a culture that they could actually respect. So they could swallow them up. When the only problem was, this assimilation never really worked because most of the time the benefits of French citizenship did not accrue to those who were quote unquote assimilated. So it was, Negritude was a reaction to this, but the kind of reaction that made the writers now basically write very essentialist kind of literature. In other words, make a point of underscoring how beautiful, how black is beautiful. Emphasize the beautiful black. Now, the problem is the essentialism kind of turned off a whole lot of people, including some African scholars and some post-colonial scholars, people like Edward Said, people like Franz Fanon, who argue that we can understand what motivates negritude, but it's not dynamic. It's not really taking us anywhere. We have to realize that culture is dynamic and we've been colonized. The influence is there, the influence of the contact is there. We have to reckon with that. Yeah. So this is exactly where the landscape looked like, in my view, when what we now call written African literature came into being. And I think that the writing of Things Fall Apart, in spite of the fact that Achebe's Things Fall Apart was not the first written work. Professor Bella gave us examples of Thomas Mofolo, of Saul Plage, of Amos Tutuola, who wrote before Achebe. But Achebe Things Fall Apart, in spite of the fact that it's a book about a particular community in southeastern Nigeria, actually makes a case, if you want, for the Africans' entry into the world, if you want. Does that make sense? He makes a case for the African in response to the degradation that colonialism had actually imposed on him. Because Things Fall Apart is the one book that clearly responds to Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness. Now, Conrad's Heart of Darkness, if you have read it, does two things. Portrays the African as belonging to a time 2,000 years back. As a matter of fact, you have Marlowe on that vessel, and he's going back in time. He's going back 2,000 years in time. That's really the metaphor of Marlowe on that vessel, on that river, going up the river. And that's where Kaz has gone and basically given up his human civilization. Marlowe is trying to make sure that that is corrected, that that situation is resolved. The reason I have a feeling that Things Fall Apart, in spite of the fact that, you know, he did a lot of other things, but writing Things Fall Apart, I think that it was his most important role, his most important duty to humanity, is that he shows the African both at his weakness and at his strength. He does not romanticize the African in spite of the fact that what he's really trying to do is reverse the image of the African that has been imposed by Conrad, Heart of Darkness. He shows the African at his weakest and at his strength, as it were, saying, yes, if you are really looking for humanity, here it is. It's both strong and weak. It's clear that in Things Fall Apart, the reason, at least that's what the narrative wants to say, the reason the conquest is so easy is because of what it says. The white man put a knife on the things that held us together and we are falling apart. I mean, that's really where Things Fall Apart come from. The white man is very clever. He came quietly and peaceably with his religion. We were foolish enough and allowed him to stay. And he has put a knife on the things that held us together and we are falling apart. So division and weaknesses, and there were all kinds of conflicts happening in the society that made it hard for them to speak with one voice once the enemy arrived. So Things Fall Apart, more than any other work, in spite of the fact that it's about a particular community, seems to speak for the continent, for the African. And Achebe wrote a metafictional response to Heart of Darkness. Maybe you've heard about his essay called An Image of Africa, Racism in Conrad's Heart of Darkness. Incidentally, that essay has elicited book-length responses. Book-length responses, one essay of about 24 pages. Because of what Achebe says there, he does a wonderful job of creating evidence for why he argues Joseph Conrad is a thoroughgoing racist. And ultimately he's arguing that, in fact, Heart of Darkness should not actually be read in schools. That's what he's saying. But then you have these central casting professors of English like Gerald Graff, who has always taught Heart of Darkness and really enjoyed it, but never mentioned the fact that Heart of Darkness is actually set in Africa. Because for him, that's irrelevant. It's the writing For him, that's important. So once he reads Achebe's essay, what Graf does, he says, I don't agree with Achebe, but what I'm going to do is every time I teach Heart of Darkness, I'm going to teach it alongside Achebe's essay and alongside Things Fall Apart. He does not commit himself on whether he thinks Conrad is a racist or not. The only thing he says is, and my students, by the way, read this essay all the time, I don't agree with Achebe. He does not say what he does not agree with Achebe about. But he gets his students, and he doesn't have to be teaching post-colonial fiction or anything. He gets his students, whenever he's teaching Heart of Darkness, to also read Things Fall Apart and read the essay by Achebe that says, Conrad is a thoroughgoing racist. Now, I myself presented a paper at a conference in which I was arguing against Achebe's idea that Heart of Darkness shouldn't be read, especially by African students.
So I just want to make sure that we get to, I'm sure there are some questions that that people will have who don't want to.
Okay, I'll be done maybe in another 3 minutes. I think that he frames, and in my post-colonial fiction classes these days, what I do is the African component of my course is comprised of Things Fall Apart and works by African women writers. And not for any other reason. Actually, I think those are great works. They make their own case for being included. One of them is Nangremka's Nervous Conditions. Another one is So Long Later. And lately, I teach the short stories of Chimamanda Adichie. I think that they map the condition of the African in a way that is much more efficient, in my view, than we have heretofore seen. And every time I read them, I feel like the originator or the inaugurator of this kind of thinking was Achebe himself in Things Fall Apart. I mean, this might be very difficult for you to believe, but in Things Fall Apart, Achebe is talking about something he calls the female principle. Mother is supreme. And then he creates this really misogynistic character who is constantly suppressing an element of his nature. And that element of his nature is supposed to be the feminine side of him. And when he commits suicide at the end, you can tell that he's not whole. He has never been whole. And the fact that he has never been whole is ultimately because of what the society has done to him by insisting, by emphasizing masculinity, but also what he himself as a tragic character has done by taking the society so seriously as to suppress a very important element of his character. Achebe is almost saying, by the way, he said before he died, he said that I'm the feminist. He said, I don't beat my wife. Obviously, he didn't mean that. But he was saying, I am really the feminist because I brought those issues to the surface. He's a critical writer who saw that the most important weakness in that society was the way in which they thought about the masculinity versus the femininity. So mother is supreme. Supreme? What does that really mean? Mother is supreme. Neka. Mother is supreme. The most important medicine of war, and this is a warlike society, the most important medicine of war is an image of an old woman. So when, in fact, my students always write a paper about feminism and Things Fall Apart, and it's compelling. It's compelling because suddenly they realize that there is so much to talk about in that book. So it makes all kinds of sense. One more minute. to think about Achebe as a harbinger in that way. And whenever I'm talking about Achebe and the women writers that I write about, I can inevitably not help introducing Frantz Fanon, who is the theorist, the main theorist of postcolonial fiction. Now, two things that Fanon did. He prophetically anticipated the problems of the national postcolonial state. He could tell that the leaders were going to let us down. So this nonsense about disillusionment, he had warned us. He said, every generation must either discover its mission or not discover it. And once you discover it, you betray it or you fulfill it. And he could tell that they were going to betray the mission if they discovered it. And my view is that a lot of them never discovered the mission. So if you don't discover the mission, you betray it by default. But he had a major failing because in his so-called pitfalls in national consciousness, he did not include the gender issue. And so in my class, every class, I have students reading ravaging critiques of this great theoretician, of how he never paid attention to this great idea, the role and status of women in postcolonial traditions.